This is The Urban Connection, the weekly show on issues that affect the community.
On this week's program, a noted law professor discusses the practice of female genital mutilation. Although it is a cultural tradition in many African and Middle Eastern countries, she argues it is quite clearly ritualized torture and needs to be outlawed.
We had a very, very fine cultural tradition in the United States called slavery. And just because something is a tradition, just because something is cultural, does not make it moral, just, or right. So that's the approach. The approach that I take is not just as a storyteller. I interject myself into the conversation by asserting that it's wrong, that it's torture, and that it needs to stop.
I'm Leonard Birdsong. The Urban Connection starts right after this.
Now, The Urban Connection continues. Once again, here's Leonard Birdsong.
Hello, folks. This is Leonard Birdsong. We're here on The Urban Connection. We have a guest today who's a noted law professor, and we're going to talk to her about her background. She has been in private practice, but she's also a professor who has received several awards for her teaching. Professor Broussard, thank you for coming on The Urban Connection. How are you doing today?
Hi, I'm well. Thank you for having me on The Urban Connection. I greatly appreciate it.
You've taught at Howard University, and you've won several teaching awards, but you also write about human rights, and particularly with a focus on women. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. I do.
Well, tell us a little bit first, though, about your background. You weren't always a lawyer and law professor. You told me that you had an interesting background, so why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, it's funny that you say that, because I have an opportunity oftentimes to speak to young folks, and I start off after they introduce me as Professor Broussard by telling them I wasn't born Professor Broussard. I was born female, poor, black, and in the projects on the west side of Chicago to a single parent. I did not have the kind of role models that kids have now. The role models I had growing up in Chicago were entrepreneurs, the black people who owned a funeral parlor, the black people who owned a rib joint, the black people who owned the cleaners. So there was still that kind of entrepreneurship on the west side of Chicago when I was growing up. So my contact with academia or with education was I had an aunt who had a couple of master's degrees, and she was married to a guy who was the first black man to receive a PhD from the University of Illinois. You know, she carried herself very regally. People seemed to respect her. She owned a home. And so, you know, I always watched that out of the side of my eye, that here was somebody who was respected for her brain.
Well, let me just say, you told me something that I want to share with our listeners. I've been a law professor myself. I was one for almost 20 years. You told me you taught second grade, and teaching second graders and teaching law students is about the same thing. I'd never heard that, and I want you to expound on that.
Well, really, when you think about it, it really is. What you're trying to do is take complex information and make it digestible for the age group that you are presenting it to. So second graders are just as clueless about diphthongs and pronouns and adjectives as law students are about torts and civil procedure and constitutional law. So both of them require an inordinate amount of patience and the ability to connect with those students and to engage them and to nourish them in a way that's appropriate for their age group. So it's very similar. You know, I have this saying with my students, same church, different pew. So that's exactly it in a nutshell.
In the sense that you beat the odds growing up on the west side of Chicago, living in the projects, you become a noted professor, but also you care for human rights, and you've told me that you want to get into human rights to talk about women and to help women. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that we all think that we want to save the world. And I think that I came to the realization that First of all, if you save yourself. And secondly, if you save just one other person, then you have incrementally saved the world. But I wanted to be able to speak and be a voice for the voiceless, for the people who can't speak for themselves. And more often than not, that's women.
And I know that you have written in the area of what's called FGM. It means female genital mutilation. You've also advocated in the immigration court for women who are facing FGM. Can you tell us, for people who don't know about it, what is FGM?
Female genital mutilation is the ritual cutting of women's genitals, and it's often couched in a ceremony that is supposed to reflect either the advancement of womanhood or the advancement to community. That's how it has been portrayed for centuries. But I wanted to examine it from another angle. I wanted to look at female genital mutilation in its darkest terms and call it torture. Let me back up a little bit how I got into this. About 2006, I read a book by an author, Catherine McKinnon, that asked the question, are women human? And I thought that was such an odd title of a book and such an odd query. But as I delved into it, I got it. I understood exactly what she meant. And she said in the book, if women were human, would they be imprisoned in their home? Would they be silenced by the veil? Would they be genitally mutilated? Would they be sold as sex slaves around the world? And I said, you know, there's something here. And when I saw that term, genital mutilation, I was like, what is she talking about? And in going back, I looked and I saw the case in the matter of Kasinga, which was a prominent case that made female genital mutilation a ground for immunity to be able to come into the country and stay into the country.
That's right. It means for asylum, as a matter of fact.
Absolutely. And I also was spurred on by a 2006 case that happened right in Atlanta, Georgia. Well, it might have been a suburb right outside of Atlanta, Georgia, but it was it was prominent in the paper, but I think it went past the heads of so many Americans because we just were not, everybody was like I was initially. What does this mean? What is this? It was the case, the Adeem case, and in the Adeem case, a father who was, I believe he had an Ethiopian background. I'm not quite sure. He had visitation of his 2-year-old daughter for the summer. He was divorced from her mother. Her mother was a African American woman, and he had her for the summer. He was angry at his mother at her mother about something. So he had his friend hold the 2-year-old down while he performed a form of female genital mutilation on her by cutting her clitoris. And the mother, he kept the girl for, I think, maybe this summer or a month or so. The mother knew nothing about it until the child got home a month later. Mother bathed her and noticed the injury, called the police, and the friend that, helped him admitted to what happened. And the reason it was such a big case was, first of all, it brought attention. I mean, anthropologists and other people who work in the areas of sociology have known about this, and human geography have known about this practice for a long time. But this is the first time this was an in-your-face case in this country. And the amazing thing about the case was there was no law that he could be prosecuted under that adequately addressed what had happened. I mean, there were rules about assault, there were rules about battery, there were rules about this and that, but nothing that specifically touched on female genital mutilation. So that in the matter of Kasinga, this whole reading of this book by Catherine McKinnon said to me, you know, this is something that I really need to investigate. I need to think about. I need to write about it and give voice to people who don't have a voice. And so that's how it started. And I knew that it was important that I be passionate about it in order to maintain a conscious deliberate way of delivering the information. Now, there is a caveat to this. I've written several articles on this, but I always have to pause after I write an article, and I have to do something that I call this palate cleansing. I have to, you know, write another article about something totally different because it's a very, very intense subject matter. Mm. It's still a very, very controversial subject matter. A lot of people say, well, you know, what right do you have to tell other cultures how they should behave and what they should consider as tradition and what they should consider as valuable to them? And I have to remind them that we had a very, very fine cultural tradition in the United States called slavery. And just because something is a tradition, just because something is cultural, does not make it moral, just, or right. So that's the approach. The approach that I take is not just as a storyteller. I interject myself into the conversation by asserting that it's wrong, that it's torture, and that it needs to stop.
Well, and I think that's a good way of putting it all, and I'm glad that you're doing this. I was, for several years before I taught, I had been in the Foreign Service, and then later on I was an immigration lawyer in Washington, D.C., among other things. And although I never had an FGM case, I knew quite a bit about it, and I did represent a lot of people who were seeking asylum, particularly from the eastern part of Africa, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Sudan, and Somalia. And back then, there were some statistics that surprised me that about 70,000 women and girls across the world every year were given FGM, and it just... Well, actually,
that's interesting because the World Health Organization has said that it's more than that. They assert that at least 200 million women who are alive and who exist on this planet today have been cut. And their statistics say it's about 2 million a year that are cut. And what's so interesting to me is, you know, One thing I didn't want to do is I didn't want to paint these countries as somehow being barbaric or behind the times or third world. But the reason I didn't want to do that was because I recognized in my research that this is happening all over the world.
It's not just Africa.
Right. And as a matter of fact, I think it was about 2006, 2007, a very large ring was broken up by the Justice Department in California. And it was broken up because the guy who was in charge of it was bragging to someone that he performed more female genital mutilation than, you know, anybody in the state. And when folks found out that, you know, it's not only performed in the United States, it's in Canada, it's throughout Europe. It's through, wherever you find people from the diaspora, that's where it's performed because people bring their culture with them. And from countries, especially some of the countries you named where there is like a 75 to 98% cuttage rate in those countries like Ethiopia, Somalia, when they migrate, they will either send their daughters home to be cut, or they will find someone in whatever their new country is.
I understand that. I've read about that, and I remember that case out in California that you talk about.
Oh yeah. So it's something that needs to be talked about. It's something that we need to discuss. It's something we cannot forget these women. I read that in the late 90s. Doctors at Howard University Hospital were so baffled. Women would come in from African countries, and they would be in labor. And when they tried to examine them, there was no opening. They couldn't find what was happening. And when they realized that they had been infibulated, and infibulation is the most severe form of female genital mutilation, where you are your vulva and your clitoris are removed, and really you're sewn back up so that if you were to run your hand over that part of a woman's body, it would be smooth, except for in the middle there would be some sort of stitching where everything had been sewn back up. And they realized that in order to deliver this baby, they had to open up this crude stitching or whatever had been used to close these women. And what was so amazing to these doctors was that many of these women would not leave the hospital until they were sewn back up.
So, oh, boy.
Oh, yeah.
Now, that part I didn't know. I knew about the doctors doing this, but I didn't know about being sewn up.
Oh, yeah. They would not leave the hospital until they were sewn back up. So, you know, just an examination of it, trying to be respectful, trying to understand that as an outsider, I can use my voice. I can be the harbinger, but you have to be culturally sensitive enough to know and to understand that it has to be a grassroots effort. It has to be, we have to take the position that we will support the men and women of these countries who want this brutal ritual to end. But for us to walk in and to just say, we're going to fix it for you, that's not how culture works. That's not how progress is made. But at the same time, we need to yell and scream and try to fix this problem. And we need to address the glaring issue of our women human. You know, I think what my research has shown me is that women are seen as not only fungible, but women and children are often just collateral damage. You know,
They can be thrown away. Absolutely.
There's a war. Yeah, all the women are going to be raped, but, you know, that's the way war works. Oh, there's poverty in the world. Oh, well, the bulk of the people who are poor are women because of the feminization of poverty. Oh, well, that's just the way it is. They're just collateral damage. So, as many of us that can scream and jump up and down and who can point to it, who can say, this is wrong, we have to fix this. It helps. It has to help. We have to keep talking about it. We have to keep doing something about it.
More of the Urban Connection, straight ahead. Stay tuned. Now back to the Urban Connection. Here's your host, Leonard Birdsong.
We are speaking with Professor Patricia Broussard about FGM, or female genital mutilation. Let me just tell the listeners, you talked about the Kasinga case for American immigration law. Miss Kasinga was a 19-year-old woman in Togo who had not had FGM, and her father was protected her and didn't let it happen. And finally, when he died, she was supposed to be subjected to FGM, but she was able to escape the country, come to the United States seeking asylum, and they put her in jail for 16 months.
Yep. Exactly.
Till a newspaper reporter for the New York Times found out about the case. She had no lawyer, but she did get a lawyer, and it was determined by the Board of Immigration Appeals that FGM is persecution. It's torture, like you say. And if you have a case for asylum, it is a ground to gain asylum in the United States. I just wanted to make sure people knew about that.
There are some sad things that are occurring in the world. First of all, with respect to the law, well, luckily the law has changed. The law has changed around the world, and laws have been instituted against this practice. The problem is enforcement. So if a family, let's say, lives in Nebraska, and they decide they want to have their daughter cut for marriageable purposes, and they send her to Ethiopia for the summer to have it done, unbeknownst to her, in order to really prosecute that case, someone would have to have examined her before she left and when she got back in order to say, well, she wasn't this way when she left and she was this way when she came back. Therefore, something could have happened. There's not that kind of manpower. There's not that kind of inquiry that goes on. So many of these cases just fall by the wayside for lack of prosecution. There was a case, I believe it was in Denmark, where these two sisters were sent to Togo for the summer thinking they were going on vacation. And they were cut. when they got home back to Denmark, they turned their parents in. And the reason they turned their parents in is because they had two younger sisters, and they did not want them to be subjected to that. So even right. though in that case you had witnesses, you had these girls who were old enough to say, this is what happened to me. I did not want this to happen to me. I was tricked. It was horrific. And Denmark had a law against it. They still were not prosecuted. So I scream, I yell, I talk about it. There are laws that have been enacted, but I think many times the laws fall on dead ears. Not only that, but something interesting has happened with the clamor against female genital mutilation. So usually when you talk about female genital mutilation, you talk about the types of genital of cutting that there is, you know, from the least severe to clipping the clitoris to the most severe, in which is infibulation, in which you remove all of the outer female organs and sew them back together. When you talk about those, you talk about the fact that what makes it so horrific is done without anesthetic. There are crude tools that are used. One razor blade may be used on 6 to 10 girls. So in describing the practice, in talking about it, and talking about how unsanitary it is, how unhealthy it is, how horrific it is and painful it is, I think the message has been misunderstood. And I say that because there has been this kind of medicalization of female genital mutilation. So families are saying, oh, okay. Oh, is that the problem? The problem is no anesthetic? Oh, fine. We'll have a doctor do it. So you have incidents of parents who take their girls now to hospitals. And the hospital, even though it's illegal in most of these countries now the law has passed since 2006, even though it's illegal, they will have a doctor perform it because they missed the point. The point is, who owns a woman's body? Does it belong to her? Does it belong to her family? Does it belong to her village? Does it belong to her father? Does it belong to her husband? So they ignore the fact that what you are doing is, this woman has a right, this girl has a right, this infant has a right to bodily integrity. But you are misinterpreting that, and you're thinking that, oh, the problem is that it's not done in sanitary conditions. The problem is that it's done, period.
You have passion for this, and I'm glad that I brought you on to talk about this, because not enough people in our community know about this. Yes. And it's not the nicest thing to talk about, but I like your passion. And right. because I only get so much time, I want to end by asking, are you doing things in the African-American community aside from writing about FGM?
I am. I am on the mayor's MLK commission, so I work very closely with them. I also mentor as many students as I can. I also work with a foundation for the homeless, and I spend a lot of time gathering necessities for them. I am an advisor for the students ACLU. I am an advisor for the Students Women's Law Caucus. I'm an advisor for the American Constitution Society. I speak when I can to various groups. And I have this really deep, deep abiding need to just let people, you've got to give back. You've got to pull somebody up with you, you know.
When do you have time to sleep?
Well.
I'm not making fun of it. It seems like you are really doing it.
Well, you know, I get it in there. I get my sleep in there, but there's work to be done. There's work to be done. And I also, you know, I'm writing about Black women in this country and how we have been ignored, disregarded, disrespected, but still we rise. So, you know, just keep busy, stay strong, and do what you can do. I mean, I wanted to change the world, and I understand now that it's done in increments.
Well, Professor Patricia Brassard, God bless all the work you're doing, and I'm really glad you've come on the Urban Connection.
Thank you.
That wraps up this episode of The Urban Connection with your host, Leonard Birdsong, a production of Syndication Networks of Chicago. Thanks for listening, and join us next time for another edition of The Urban Connection.